Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to host you. Really excited to dig in. So, Jonathan is the CEO and founder of Grok, which has built a high performance AI. Jonathan, we should get a quick demo of that at the
Oh,
outset
really?
as well. I think it'd be fun. And just to tee up, Jonathan, so Google has this policy of enabling engineers to have 20% of their time to work on these crazy skunk work projects. And Jonathan, while he was there, was one of the crazy engineers that, with all the affection of the world, developed the TPU.
That's correct.
And the TPU is a rival to the GPU. And we'll get into these differences between GPUs and TPUs. CPUs were the 60s through the 90s, and then also LPUs as well. We're going to talk about the winners and losers in AI, the future of AI, when should we expect AGI, and we'll also get into the personal motivations that Jonathan has for developing Grok. So why don't we start with that demo? I thought this was
All right.
wildly fast. Is there a way to share a screen
Do you see
here?
it now?
Adding,
There it is.
there you go.
All
Okay.
right. Why don't you ask me a question? But while you're thinking of a question, I'll explain.
I got a question.
Oh, really? Okay, but let me explain so people understand what they're looking at. So this is Llama 2 70 billion. This is the model, the largest model that Meta has open sourced. Meta has been in the news a little bit for making LLMs available to everyone, right? But typically they run slow because they're these big models, they're expensive to run. So typically you'll get maybe 10 words per second or something out of this. And now this one is running on our hardware, so it'll be a little faster. So go ahead and ask a question.
What semiconductor stock should I purchase?
Oh, and by the way, can you still see it or did I mess it up?
I can still see it.
Okay, perfect. What semiconductor stock should I purchase?
Yep.
And there it's done.
That was fast. That was lightning fast.
That was speedy. That was the typical responses that we get and that are acceptable are wow or a string of expletives is the typical.
If I asked GPT OpenAI to do that, it would probably have finished maybe 4 seconds ago. It would still be processing.
Yeah, it would still be going. We have some comparisons that we've put up, but not a perfectly fair comparison. Their model is technically bigger, but they've also shrunk it by distilling. We haven't distilled, so it's fair. One thing that's clear though, if you were running GPT on our hardware, it would probably be about this fast.
I think the main takeaway here is that the winners and losers at the application layer are not yet resolved. We're still in the early innings. If you think back to the late 90s with the search wars where we had Alta Vista and Lycos and X-Sight, it wasn't until a few years where Google had a technical breakthrough with PageRank, and that then led them to crush the competition. Yahoo's gone. I think it's quite interesting. This is an example of a technical breakthrough, and that stems from your engineering background. This is a good segue into Grok. Why don't you introduce Grok? Is it a software play? Is it a hardware play? Who do you comp to?
Yeah, trying to compare us is a little bit of a problem because we're not exactly like any other company.
You're a unicorn, financially, market cap, and also positioning. Go ahead.
So we build the chips, but we're really offering the service as an API. And we are willing to sell the systems and the chips, but we're mostly selling the API at the moment. So just like you would buy tokens of capacity from a Jeep, from an OpenAI, from an Anthropic, and so on. Now we're running the open source models, right? So there are some people who either want an open source model for philosophical reasons, just inherently, that's all they're comfortable with. There's some people who need speed. And this is where we have a huge advantage. We don't directly compete with NVIDIA or AMD or anyone else. In fact, I think 2 weeks ago, someone came to us and their use case was not latency sensitive. And we would have been less expensive for them to run on us than on GPUs. But we declined the business because we're focused on those who need latency, where they can't get their problem solved anywhere else.
Finance has plenty of latency
Finance,
demands, low.
I would say those who are representing, so customer representative sort of tools like
Sure.
live coaching, anything involving the loading of web pages, that's typically very time sensitive ads, but very time sensitive applications.
Got it. So you expose an API and you're primarily targeting enterprise customers?
That's correct.
And have you designed your own chip?
That's right. So your chip. Actually, okay. I have one here. So this is one of our...
So it's hardware and software.
That's correct. So this chip right here, this is the first petaop chip that's 1 quadrillion operations per second that was ever built. And so we built that.
It's a petaop?
Petaop.
That's petaop. Okay, I learned something new.
So you've heard of gigaops. You've heard of teraops. This is a petaop. So one followed by, I think, 15 zeros, but I'm not even sure it's so big.
How does that compare to the standard of art in the market?
So I think the latest GPUs can do a petaop, but there's a difference, right? The difference is when you're using a GPU, GPUs are really great at training models. When someone wants to train a model, I'm like, just use GPUs. Don't talk to us. Because they can get the same number of ops as we can. But the big difference is when you're running one of these models, not training them, running them after they've already been made.
Inference.
You can't produce the 100th word until you've produced the 99th. And so there is a sequential component to them that you just simply can't get out of a GPU. And that's why they're so slow. So it's how quickly you complete the computation, not just how many computations you can do in parallel. And we do the computations much faster.
Understood. And is that the LPU design? Is that what's informed?
That's correct.
The hardware? Do you want to frame up the distinctions? Maybe even start with the CPU briefly, and then GPU, TPU, and LPU. If we can get like a 3-minute kind of primer and the main differentiation here.
Sure. CPUs, they first became popular in the 70s. And the value of a CPU, why you're using them today, why they become such a big deal, is that they were easy to program. Before CPUs, you physically had to rewire a computer. It took a lot of time, a lot of expertise. You couldn't just download the configuration. You had to rewire them. What GPUs did was, with the same amount of silicon, that thing that I showed you, the chip, while they couldn't do things very fast in a sequence, they could do a lot of dumb operations in parallel. And why that was important was, as we started getting graphical user interfaces, like the buttons that are on your phone and in web pages and all that, they made it much easier to use computers, but they were very expensive to render. And so you needed these special chips to do that. Mm-hmm. The LPU, as I mentioned, it doesn't just do computation in parallel. It also does it in a short time period. So it gives you a little bit of both. So when you have a sequence of things, when you have text, when you're trying to complete the next sequence in a genome, or indeed when you're trying to figure out the next move in a strategy game or the next note in a song, all of that depends on what came before. And you can't do it in parallel. Each pixel on the screen is rendered independently. They don't need to rely on each other. But when it comes to language, every word follows a previous word.
Where ordering matters, when the sequencing matters, that's where the LPU has an advantage over a GPU. A GPU is rendering pixels on a screen. You can parallelize that. But an LPU, the sequence matters.
That's correct. And like literally people just go, wow. But from a business point of view, to understand why this actually matters, we're in the MySpace age of LLMs, where MySpace actually measured the number of accounts signed up. Whereas Facebook measured monthly active and then eventually daily active users, engagement, right? The first principle of engagement is latency. I want you to imagine going to a website and it's loading. You've already bounced. You're already like, what's wrong? I'm going to go somewhere else. So the fact that it takes a minute to get an answer right now is one of the reasons that the engagement on these large language models is so
high. Absolutely. No, I agree. It's a source of frustration not being able to get an answer instantly. Of course, you know better than anyone else, Google invested a lot of time in reducing the latency in the responsive search because they saw more usage from that investment.
That's right. So they started off with enough quality that it was usable. And then it was all about the latency. And I don't know if you remember, there was a little timestamp for how long it took to give an answer on Google. Was not there for your benefit. That was to make sure that the engineers inside of Google were always thinking about it and keeping it low.
Fascinating. So Let's jump back to the TPU, and then we'll come back to LPU use cases, especially around genomics and defense and encryption. I'm sure those are some questions you're probably getting to. But so what's the driver for the development of the TPU? How does it compare to the GPU?
We built the TPU at Google because we had actually trained models that outperformed human beings. And we did the math. Actually, this engineer named Jeff Dean, very famous at Google, had done the math. And he did a presentation to the leadership team. And it was two slides. And the first slide was, good news, machine learning finally works. We have a speech recognition model. Outperforms human beings. Slide number two, bad news, we can't afford it. We need to double or triple our global data center footprint. That's another $20 to $40 billion at the time. It's more now. And that's for speech recognition. If we want to do anything else, use it in ads or search or something, it's going to cost us a lot more. That was internally branded the success disaster. Success in that AI worked, disaster as in can't do it. As a side project to 20%, I happened to sit near the speech recognition team in New York. That's where they were. And we were having lunch one day and they were telling me about this. And I'm like, I could try and get this working on an FPGA. And they're like, great, do it. And they gave me a desk and started working on it at night and got it working. And then Jeff Dean, to his credit, he did a back of the envelope. And he's like, you know what? We just build our own chip. It's going to be way cheaper than buying these FPGAs. He was right. So we built a chip. We're like, how hard could that possibly be? Turns out it's very hard, but when you don't know that it's going to be hard, you get into it. So we built that first chip with about, I think, 15 people. And so when starting Grok, the question that we had, we weren't initially going to do a chip. That wasn't the idea. What happened was right around that time, the TPU paper came out. And so that's all VCs wanted to ask us about. And I remember one of them asked, what would you do differently? And I'm like, oh, I'd fix the software because the software is completely broken. Like you have to write software you're writing assembly code by hand. It takes forever. You're like, do you think you could fix it?
As compared to CUDA, for example, the NVIDIA.
That's exactly the same. So NVIDIA has, and most people don't realize this, NVIDIA has about 10,000-ish people who write these things called CUDA kernels. It's not CUDA, it's CUDA kernels.
Got it.
And for example, there is a way to implement machine learning models called PyTorch. It's the most popular way at the moment. I think there's about 60 different, what are called convolutional kernels, just for the latest generation of NVIDIA GPU. They're all handwritten. And they're all like, ooh, when this parameter is like this, do this one. When this parameter is like this, do this one. And so it's a double-sided market in a way, right? Like classic, hard to penetrate market where if you want to compete with NVIDIA, not only do you have to have 10,000 people doing this and having had them do it for a while, NVIDIA also points out that there's about 40,000 people in the wild writing these kernels for their GPUs. And so this is why it's crazy that people are trying to compete with NVIDIA and GPUs. It'd be like competing with Netflix, like having to make all your own content. It's going to cost you a fortune. You're never really going to get there. Unless you already have a ton of content. In this case, no one has a bunch of kernels. So when the brain team at Google wrote TensorFlow, they had to write the kernels for the NVIDIA GPUs or they wouldn't be relevant. Double-sided market.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
So when we started, we spent the first 6 months working on our compiler with no kernels. We have 800 different models compiling for our LPUs. No kernels, just works.
You're the equivalent of an assembly language writing as opposed to higher abstract programming.
I think the analogy would be if we were a streaming service competing against Netflix, it's as if we built our stuff in a way where we have the legal right to run the content of anyone else, not just Netflix, but Disney, HBO Max, all the others. And we're only like a day after all of them in having the content available, even though they spent how long getting it to work or creating the content. So we're like the super content provider. So we have all the content. Any model you want to run, we have. We even have stuff that doesn't run on NVIDIA very well.
And so that was the problem statement. So the success, major disaster scenario moment at Google.
This is Grok. Grok. This is great. Right. Didn't solve the software problem while there and had to build a very different architecture in order to avoid that problem with Grok.
Got it. And that architecture is what you've dubbed the LPU.
That's correct.
Got it. And no one else has this LPU architecture. Is that branding or is it an architectural distinction? Could you articulate a bit more, like what are the both. Key architectural decisions? Both.
Yeah. Okay. So,
right. You want to be a market of one, right?
The reason that the architect, some of the differences in the architecture, we literally forbid people for, you see that whiteboard behind me? Those were forbidden for like the first 6 months at Grok because people kept trying to draw pictures of chips. And if you start with the chip, you end up with something that's impossible to get the software working for, right?
It's like you worked backwards from your objective.
So we spent the first 6 months on the compiler. And there are physical things about our chip that with more technical audiences, I can point out and be like, this thing right here, if we hadn't done it this way, we would have what's called NP complete problem. And NP complete problems are intractable. Like they're as difficult as breaking cryptography on the internet. Right. And there's about seven of those when you compile for a GPU. So people don't even try and solve them. They're just like, we'll do best effort with a human being. But you don't do very well. You can see the speed of our chip. We do very well in large part because we've avoided all of those problems. And that's automatically compiled. No human being hand optimizing for our chip.
I see. So you will avoid NP problems, like the traveling salesman problem.
You know what I'm talking about. Okay.
The Dijkstra's algorithm, a few different techniques out there. So that's where CPUs and other technical approaches can take to run optimizations there. But you've narrowed the scope on a commercially valuable opportunity set and specialize your hardware, working backwards from the compiler down to what hardware technical specs are required to deliver.
That's correct.
Gotcha. Okay, great. So that chip, now how the heck do you build a chip, by the way? Do you call up a foundry fabricator? Do you work with Synovus and different, what does that journey look like?
1-800 chips are us. No. So our first chip is built with Global Foundries. That's a fab that's in the US. So our chips are manufactured in the US. We package them in Canada. We assemble the systems in California. The data center's in Washington State. So we're North American. And as we scale up manufacture, we're probably going to do quite a bit of it in Mexico. So we like being North American.
Less Taiwan risk.
We don't have
and CHIPS Act beneficiary as well.
Not directly, but indirectly. That doesn't go to the companies like us. That goes to companies like Intel and others, right? Our second generation chip is being fabbed with Samsung in Taylor, Texas, because they're building a very large fab there. And that is going to allow us to stay in the US for yet another generation. Mm-hmm. But
got it. Understood.
Yeah.
So you have these chips, but you're not selling these LPUs. You maintain them. You've got them in some.
You are selling as a system. So
as a system,
okay. We have one partner that sells the chips. Everyone else sells the systems, and they actually build systems with our chips and sell those systems.
That's like an on-prem solution.
That's correct.
If they buy the system. Else they can rent your APIs and you charge them, say, on a per token basis,
correct.
Minimum token consumption, something
per,
like that.
Per token, or you can, if you're going to buy a large number, you can buy a certain number of tokens per second from us, and we will guarantee that.
Got it. And where are you in the life cycle of the business now?
So I'm in the office in the weekends ramping up supply chain phase. So I think up until we had the demo, maybe 2 to 3 months ago, we were in the trying to convince people we had something special phase. And so demand was very difficult to get.
Sure.
Now, when people see that demo, it's, I want that. When can I have that? And so we're in the building up supply phase. Trying to figure out how to size this up. But
really get it. So you established proof of concept. You showed the value. You can illustrate it in about 1 minute.
Doesn't take a minute.
Just like we illustrated here. And now customers say, okay, I'm interested. I want more.
Yeah.
And so then are you building a pipeline of customers and say, all right, great. And then you start contracting around that. And hopefully they can give you some upfront financing like GFS did with, I think it's the Defense Department and a few other foundries are doing. And then you're going to turn around and start fulfilling. So you've got that demand pipeline that you're growing, and then you'll start fulfilling and then booking cash flow.
That's right. And there's one other really important way to think about us, which is, so we have an orthogonal supply chain to the GPU supply chain. when you are buying GPUs, it doesn't really matter whom you are buying them from, whether it is NVIDIA, AMD, or someone else, you're buying HBM. And HBM is a component that goes in those GPUs, and it's very limited. There is no extra capacity by buying from one vendor or the other, so you're limited. And that's why we've had this shortage. We don't use those components. We're not using the same fabs. We're not using the same supply chain at all. Very little overlaps at all. And so we're adding extra capacity to the market. But in addition to
that, that's really interesting. You release a constraint on the demand for inference.
That's correct.
There's a lot of demand for inference. So how do you charge then per token?
At the moment,
are you doing price discovery now? Maybe it's too
early. We're in discovery, but the way to think about it is, we can fundamentally get more tokens per second out of our hardware than you can with a GPU, because you actually have to read all of that memory for every token you produce, and that takes a while, it's slow, and so on.
Slow.
So all of the memory is in our chips. So we don't have to read.
So that's one of the additional technical innovations.
Yeah, because otherwise we would have been as reliant on HBM as everyone else. It was funny because I saw all these benchmarks coming out from very different architectures, and they all performed the same. And it was because they were all relying on the same memory, and they were all bottlenecked on it.
And so would you file a patent on this IP, or does that disclose IP to your competitors so you wouldn't? What's the move you make there?
We have 70 different patent families. Patent families. That said, even with that, we still have a lot of trade secret. But the reality is, as I mentioned, we started with a compiler, and we ended up having to go through, I think it was in total, 4 compiler teams before we were able to do it. Because it wasn't just about doing it right. It was also about not introducing other concepts.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So even when you start with this and you know exactly what you're doing, it's really hard to stay on. We've seen at least 3 other companies that claim they're going to like literally copy us. And we're watching what they're doing, and it doesn't seem like they've fully figured it out. They're like making
You firewalled your IP at the team level, so that no one can connect all the
dots. It's just too hard. It's right. Even when you know exactly, we published 2 ISCA papers. That's like the New England Journal of Medicine. Here's the thing. It's really hard to copy a company that does 2 very hard things, right? So that's why FPGAs for a long time have been so difficult to copy, because they do a chip and they do their own software. We do our own chip. We do our own networking. We do our own systems. We do our own runtime. We do our own compiler. And we do our own orchestration.
You don't work with a Broadcom or a KLAG?
Well, you work with those sorts of folks to do the back-end design. And so we did get some help in the back-end design, but there's no magic there, right? It was just standard. Yeah,
that's commodity.
Commodity, right? Yeah. And we didn't do our own because there was nothing we could add there. But the point here is someone would need to replicate all that. And the thing is, by the time anyone would do that, we'd be so far ahead, it wouldn't matter. And frankly, we'd just acqui-hire anyone who did that, because that would be impressive that they could. But it wouldn't matter. We'd be so far. We're already working on our next generation and our next generation's next generation.
And it reduces the risk that you lose talent for $10 million annual offers, which we're seeing from OpenAI and poaching people from Google and so forth for the same reason.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It's exceedingly unlikely that someone would be able to just, that's just not, this one's a little too complicated.
I find the firewalling of talent and ideas, I think that's just quite interesting. So in terms of the business,
it's too high dimensional.
It's too high dimensional. Now, how would you approach your business today in terms of the finance? Have you done like seed, series? Like, where are you in that journey?
So we've raised $400 million, and our last round was a Series C. I think publicly disclosed, it was a little less than that. We had a strategic put in some money as well. But yeah, we're pretty far along.
So strategic, I assume that means a hyperscaler or a competitor to NVIDIA or has not been announced. All right. Gotcha. Okay, good. And now you're transitioning to delivering the products to market and starting to generate revenue. And the scope of opportunity you have is quite broad. The hardest decisions must be around, where do you focus? Like, what customer target, what industry target, the hardware versus software plays, how to package the offering to the market. All the go-to-market questions, how do you say no to so you can create more focus?
No, that's right. And we've actually, all of our internal arguments have been about whom do we give access to our hardware to, like the tokens, like who gets the next set of tokens? That's the debates that we always have internally now.
Mm-hmm. And how do you approach that? What are the principles that you apply? Like size of budget, long-term customer?
Number one, are you already doing something in this space? If you are, we like you. If you're just like tire kicking, you're like, LLMs, my board told me I need to do something with that, but I haven't figured out what I'm going to do. Typically won't work with that.
Commitment and evidence by track. They're paying money today to the category. So you screen, you filter right away, you qualify.
The ones that we're working with in earnest are the ones that have a LLM product. It exists. It's very interesting. Like their product is built on it and like it has usage. And the problem is they don't have the engagement that they want. And they want to increase that engagement
right.
by speeding it up. Because that's the one thing you can do to always increase engagement.
Absolutely. So you would be selling then to all the competitors to OpenAI that are springing up, that are looking for greater speed to drive more engagement with their users. But I don't know why you couldn't directly sell to an OpenAI or Google, because wouldn't presumably they benefit from greater speed as well? Or would they prefer an in-house approach?
I don't know anyone who wouldn't benefit.
Got it. So what categories are you most excited about? There's so many application areas here. You talked about genomics and DNA. That's one. Biotechnology, defense. I don't know if encryption cracking is on the table. My instinct is that it wouldn't be, although it's great sales and marketing, and maybe you'll push back on that.
We have a customer who's implemented a very efficient Qubo solver on our hardware that actually outperforms quantum computers. And that is something that is typically used for that application. That said, they haven't told us what it's being used for, so we have no idea.
It's a three-letter customer. Gotcha.
That's not a three-letter customer. That's a commercial entity.
Gotcha. So within those categories, where do you feel like you've got the most traction? Maybe it's too early to measure that. I know you're going through customer discovery. It's a big world out there. Is it the finance or the biotechnology or the defense application, the LLMs, solving their needs seems like the immediate focus. Is that fair?
Where we've discovered the simplest sales motion is when someone is in a market currently getting money for a non-latency sensitive LLM application. Mm-hmm. And they've realized, and their customers agree, that if they could decrease the latency, they would have a completely game-changing product that's a little bit different. For example, going from fraud detection to fraud prevention.
You want a 10x improvement.
Right? Or more, right? And it really, like that speed matters.
So card issuers, Visa, MasterCard, the banks, they would benefit from all of that.
Those would be places where it would matter. And any place where speed is the name of the game.
Right.
And where they're doing things in this space, but they haven't been able to do everything because of the lack of speed.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we don't want to just, like, in the end, we will probably win on price always. But if we are competing on price, the problem is one of the large incumbents can always protect what they have by just going lower and trying to kill us. So we're going only in spaces where there really is no overlap. Like this,
right.
Gives me an option.
Presumably, one of these large players would knock on your door and seek to acquire the IP. That would be one. And number two is you grow and you seek a public markets IPO. Maybe it's too premature to talk about these things. Of course, you think about these things, certainly when you start the business. How do you envision the company looks a few years from now?
It's funny you should mention that, because so we're not looking to sell. Like right now, we're just looking at how do we fulfill demand. Sure. That's really our
focus. Execute.
Right. One of the very common questions that we've gotten over and over again, because we don't use these kernels, because we can take software and because we can actually spit out literally just, here's the ideal chip for your software. One question we've gotten asked a lot is, could you help us build our own chip? It's not an area that we're in right now, but all the best businesses are ones where you're at some point you go, why do we keep saying no? And actually that's how we got into the API side of it, because we were selling the systems and we just kept getting asked, can you do an API? And we're, we,
to build the demo, we had to have the internal things to get there. And we're like, okay, what does it take to productionize that? And so we've been building a team around that. And we're
right
within the next, it's possible that within 2 weeks, we may have our first production customer actually running on that for their actual production workloads.
Gotcha. So you have market expansion opportunities. Like the path to success for any business always marked by the siren songs of, can you do this for us? Can you do that for us?
Actually, here's a fun one. We've actually had people using our demo instead of GPT. We've actually had a couple of reporters tell us that they're actually using us instead of GPT. And we're running stock Llama 2 70 billion, which we downloaded off the internet. And so as we're asked more, we're like, we discovered the sort of obvious. It's so fast. They can iterate. They can ask a question, get an answer, and go, oh no, I meant this. And it just updates, right?
Right.
So when you have that different experience, it's more engaging and you can stick to it. And so if you're actually trying to accomplish a task, you'd much rather have two or three times the iterations in a smaller period of time and ask clarifying questions and redirect than to just be like, give me the perfect, oh, now I have to wait another minute because it has this one thing in it that I need it to fix or whatever.
Understood. So just to play it back, the main innovation started with design the right compiler so you can attract your end target, the developers, take away their pain points. You work backward, develop the appropriate hardware and unique IP within that. And now you're building demand across a broad range of verticals. And it looks like you got a number of different opportunities to get after in the future. Is there anything else you want to share around Grok? Otherwise, we'll shift to winners and losers within AI, as well as the philosophy of AI and when do we see AGI and those other fun topics.
I think the one thing to keep in mind about Grok is that it is spelled with a Q.
So you have the Elon Musk version of Grok. Anything you want to share around there? Any trademark disputes that came up? Who was there first? It sounds like you were there first. If you raised 400 million, you've been around for a while.
I don't think we need to get too much into that, but just remember, it's spelled with a Q. And
right. Just
make sure. Yeah, watch this space. All right.
We'll get the URL in the show notes and under the thread too. Understood. All right. So let's talk about the future of AI and AI philosophy. This is a great quote I saw the other day. It says, those who know AI will displace those who don't know AI. We're seeing that in a lot of ways. Startups and businesses that can embrace AI are more productive more quickly. Although these AIs today are still performing at intern level, they require a lot of assessment and rework and quality control. So my own view is that it's a slow takeoff world. When do you think we get to a world where we have competency from the AIs that are at the human level, where people start to say, instead of approaching AI as a productivity enabler, instead of taking that engineer and making them a 10x engineer, we start approaching AI and saying, I don't need the engineer. It's more of a displacement.
So I think you are quoting me, but I was quoting someone else, and that person was quoting someone else. So that's been going around quite a bit. And the actual quote is, it's not that AI is going to replace people. It's that people who know how to use AI will replace people who don't. And the reason is it's a huge productivity multiplier. Another quote that I heard recently from someone was, the best way to think about these LLMs and AI and generative AI is a differently abled coworker, because they make mistakes, but they also get a bunch of things right that you're not going to get right. For example, you can just go into like the demo I was showing earlier, you can just ask it, come up with a table of these things and it will. Or you could ask it, write a job description for this and it will. Just nearly instantly.
Right.
But then you're going to help tweak it and make it better. That's probably going to be true for quite a while.
Years. That makes sense to me. We've got a long way to go to get a true labor market displacement. Outside of copywriting and certain functions today, we're already seeing less creatives due to the capability.
I'm seeing people who, like, just look at it this way. Have you noticed the surge in art in news articles? Like, news articles now have some art when before they didn't, because it's so inexpensive to build. So you're actually getting more people, and you will see professionals whose actual job is to make that art
because they're better at using these models than other people.
That's the prompt engineer, JD. That's what you're saying. You're saying, hey, find people that are proficient and skillful. But I hear you. I think that's a temporary role. If I think the fact that you need prompt engineers means that the AI isn't skillful enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a world where AI is effective, there's no need to have tortured iteration on prompt design. The AI will have the context of your goals. And if it doesn't have that, it'll ask for that in the same way that you would have a similar experience working with a colleague.
Prompt engineering will probably always exist for the same reason that software engineering will always exist. It will just be, and by the way, it will, all of these disciplines over time will grow in size, but the next thing that comes will grow larger, faster, right? We have more chip designers today than we had in the 70s before we really had software.
The growth market.
But we have way more software engineers, and we will then have way more prompt engineers. And whatever comes next, we will have way more of those.
So like we have Squarespace now, and we have fewer HTML5 editors, let's say. That's the thesis I'm making here, is that, yes, engineers will go up over time, but the need for this very narrow, specialized prompt engineering, I'm not so sure. We have the rise of no-code tools now. We'll see, but when would you imagine...
Go ahead. Argue. So you're thinking of prompt engineering as the art of crafting the prompt. I would call that more a prompt professional. When I think of a prompt engineer, I think of the person who is building the system that operates without a human. So for example, a customer support system. And there's always going to be someone who's going to have to deal with the quality on that and improve that. Now,
right.
You could imagine, the one interesting thing that I've been seeing recently is I've seen a couple of cases, which I can't talk about because they were shared with me in confidence, of these projects that were built inside of companies using large language models, where it's literally like one or two engineers spent like a weekend and built something where I guarantee you, had this thing existed even 6 to 12 months ago, that would be like a billion-dollar unicorn company doing those things, and they were done in a weekend with a single engineer. And there's a couple of these things where I'm like, please turn this into a product because we would use this. And it wouldn't take us that long to implement, but there's so many of them. Like, we can't even have someone go and do
that. That's great. We're seeing acceleration then in development. I'm looking forward to that. I see a lot of churn in these apps that are being created, turned out, and it's a small fraction that's hitting the mark, but you can see the potential. It's going to take some time. I get your point on the prompt engineering. It's about the workflow. It's about the orchestration, the quality control, and tracing inputs to outputs. How do people interact with that along the
way? And I would say that LLMs are a hammer and we're still looking for the nail. Chatbots are not the nail. They're like, I don't know, maybe they're like the coconut that you break with a hammer or something, right? They're useful. They're juicy.
Right.
But we're still waiting for the nail. And the nail is the reason everyone has a hammer in their home.
Right on. Said. So when AGI, if it's not in the next few years, when are we going to see this? Are we going to see this?
What is AGI? AGI, artificial general intelligence. The definition has shifted a little bit. It used to be people were like, AGI is when you can beat the Turing test. We beat the Turing test.
Ray Kurzweil definition of AGI.
What's his definition?
We should look up the exact definition, but it is a super intelligent artificial system. It's smarter than humans, has access to real-time information.
How do I test that? So let me give my favorite new definition, which people had to scramble to come up with something new because the Turing test is over, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
So the new one is go earn $1 million. When you have an LLM that can go make $1 million of profit,
interesting test.
Because that's a hard thing to do. And fundamentally, if you can do that, like that's a valuable thing, right? That's like the new test that I've heard.
There's someone out there already started a business with AI and they made some money around this and it's on Twitter. Like part of it, the reason why it's successful because they were one of the first to get out there and incorporate social media into all this. So I don't think that qualifies for the test. You have these news reports and speculation around maybe the reason why Sam was ousted at OpenAI is they had some deep technical breakthrough. I'm highly skeptical of that. It just doesn't make sense, just given where the state of the art is today and the latency and where we are in the innovation curve and just some intuition around that. So it sounds like that it's, in my estimation, it's at least 5+ years away. I think there's a little bit more hype than delivery on that. Now, yes, to your point, what's the appropriate way to measure it? But I think we'll know when it's here. We'll have indicia of evidence in the world. Ideally, it's direct evidence. It's not implicit evidence, meaning you're not seeing a or corporate or sovereign take advantage of an AGI in an untoward ways. There's a great book by Max Tegmark called Life 3.0, where it's a fiction book, but it's incredibly creative. And he envisions a world where we stumble upon AGI, but in a very indirect way, and what that means and how it's felt in the world.
I don't think we understand what's hard yet. If you go back historically, when the first calculators, the first like mechanical calculators were built, everyone was like, oh my gosh, this is human intelligence. No, seriously, because at the time, arithmetic was considered this human facility. And we were like, oh my gosh, right? Then what happens? Eventually you get to the point where Deep Blue beats a human being in chess. And we're like, oh, AI is about to be here.
Another moment.
Yeah. Then with Go, the same thing happened. With language, we had the same moment, but we're not there yet.
We're not. Not even fourth grade math yet.
But we don't know. We don't actually know what those things are. It's why we had to revise the Turing test, because clearly these things are not intelligent in the way that we are, but they can do a thing that was uniquely human before. The question that we have is how many uniquely human things are left? And I don't think we know.
I'll propose one.
Go for it.
I'll call it human intuition. So what we learn in philosophy of science is that you have deductive evidence and you have inductive evidence. All of science is inductive by nature. Right? Deduction is you have premise, conclusion. Mm-hmm. You can crank that out on a computer if you want. But human intuition, I don't think is explained by science.
It is very clearly explained by these models. Remember.
Go ahead.
Okay. Tic-tac-toe. You have 9 moves you can make at the start and it winnows down from there. You can just memorize how to play that. That's easy.
Right.
Chess is a little harder. There's 30 moves you can make. Little harder. Go was so hard to beat because there were 360 moves that you could make. That made it dramatically harder than the 30 moves from chess.
And we have conquered Go.
Go. But here's the thing. The way that worked was in chess, you could brute force it and beat a world champion human, right? There was some heuristics, but it was mostly brute force. With Go, with 360 moves, what the models did was they were trained on historic games. In those historic games, as you trained, when the model looked at the board, it would go, oh, this is the most likely move. This is the second most likely. This is the third. So maybe you spit out 10 or something, right? And now you just try those 10. You move one step forward and you go, okay, what are the 10 counter moves for each of those? And you play them out a little bit so you keep the space small so a bit of compute can get you there. And that's great. We could beat the European champion with a little bit of that, but the world champion, we needed a lot more compute. That's why we use the TPU when playing Lee Sedol, but we were able to beat Han when we were using GPUs. Here's the thing though, language, 32,000 different tokens you can select from. That is 100 times more intense or more computationally at each step, and it compounds. But the choice of word is intuition.
I hear you. Look, there's a search space in the game of Go, and the DeepMind team found that their application of Go actually discovered new strategies that humans hadn't previously explored.
No, that's not accurate. So that's not accurate. Yeah. So move 37 in the second game, the shoulder hit, the creative move, where the commentators were all like, was that a mistake? And Lee Sedol, he sat down after a smoke break and saw that, and his body language, oh my gosh. He immediately recognized it was a problem move for him.
Yeah.
That was a 1 in 10,000 game move. It was in the moves that we're trained on. It didn't come out of nowhere. The reason it was creative is because it was so unlikely to be the right move that when we went back and we tried it on the GPUs, never once played it because they couldn't search deep enough to find it. But with compute from those TPUs, we're able to get that far find it, play it. Now, here's the cool thing.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
It recognized that it was a good move. It knew that it was a good move to play, right? Mm-hmm. And that was difficult. But by being able to play out a couple of moves and see how it evolved, it was able to recognize that this move, which is very rarely played and I would never normally consider, is the right move in this rare circumstance.
So it was recognizing the value of that move by going deeper in the search tree.
Correct.
Okay.
And this is the way your brain works too. So when you are speaking, I can ask you, what is the next word that I'm about to
say?
Correct. Now, if I ask you, what is the second derivative of the square of the hyperbolic tangent?
Cosine, negative cosine?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But you don't know.
Well, GPT about that.
Okay. But did you know that you didn't know, or were you confident?
My confidence level was low.
Okay. That confidence level is important because that's how you can go, you know what? This isn't the right move to play. Or I need to think about this more. I need to keep searching that space to find the right move.
I think it's an interesting philosophical point. My definition of intuition is something that transcends the evidence we're presented with. It's something that goes beyond the nature of search. Like when Einstein was intuiting the nature of space-time, that search didn't occur in the space of language or words. It was a deep physical intuition he had. And the nature of that reflection, I don't believe it was linguistic either. Actually, they defined the language through the geometry of surfaces, like Riemann surfaces.
He had a kinesthetic sense that he was intuiting through and feeling. And I totally understand that. But don't forget that everything that a human being does involves making predictions, ranking.
Yeah.
And then when you think deeply or you hesitate, you're considering the options and going a little deeper. And so I guarantee you that Einstein, when he was working through those formulas, because he always said he was never really good at math. He was doing that search in his head. But at some point it clicked for him, and it was the same kind of intuition.
So that clicked. It's the eureka moment. It's a flash of insight. And that's what I'm getting at with intuition.
But here's, I can explain to you what that eureka moment is, because these models can have it too. And that eureka moment, that shoulder hit move in game two of AlphaGo was a eureka moment. Why was it a eureka moment? Because all of the highly ranked moves were the moves that weren't played. When you have to go far down your probability distribution, find something, and then all of a sudden when you play it out, the cumulative probability is higher, you're like, oh my gosh, that's better. I need to pay attention to this and I need to learn from this. That is your eureka moment. When you discover something that starts off low probability, but when you play it out, it's high probability.
Understood. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Now, I think the other kind of Turing test would be, I don't even know if in principle this is testable. I believe it's actually not testable, would be, does a potential future AGI have subjective experience? I don't think that's testable. I can't validate that you have subjective experience and vice versa, right? We have these trust assumptions based on the fact that we look similar. We have two arms and two legs and we walk around and we have a language and it seems like we mean the same thing. We can make predictions about how we behave when we act in certain ways. But I think there's going to be a whole range of just ethical considerations as AGI emerges. And I think the number one piece that'll turn on would be, does the AGI have subjective experience? Is it conscious or does it act like it has subjective experience?
There are plenty of questions in philosophy that they're interestingly phrased in a way that makes them harder to answer than is necessary, that causes us to spend a lot of time dwelling on them. One of my favorite examples is cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. I mean, it's in the statement that I think therefore I am, like it's presupposed. But bottom line, someone takes some mushrooms and they lose their sense of self, right? People have strokes and they lose their sense of self. This is a part of the brain that gives you a sense of self, because without it, you couldn't survive. If you couldn't tell where you began and where you ended, then you might as well just give all of your supplies to someone else. But that extends to your family because that's important for the survival of your genes and so on, right? When it comes to subjective experience and all of that. I think there's a lot of words that we use that don't have a firm, clear definition, that are begging for a firm, clear definition that could make them make sense. My favorite is sentience. So we use that word a lot. And that word has been used for a long time. So there is no real, like, it didn't come from a place with a formal definition, but you could impose one. And the one that I would impose is that whereas intelligence is what you can do now, sentience is your rate of improvement of that intelligence. It's your ability to reflect and learn and improve. And from a sort of more mathematical place, sentience is your ability, that rate to improve. So if you were to have an ELO score, like in chess, in Go, you have a score which predicts your likelihood to win against someone else, right? In Go, about a 200 ELO score difference is insurmountable. If someone has 200 better, you're going to lose those. The question is, Lee Sedol, he had an ELO score of between 3,600 and 3,700, or 35 and 36, somewhere in that range. And AlphaGo that he played against, not the test game that he had, the actual competition, was like 37 and a half. It was like 150 or so ELO points above him. It was basically all but guaranteed to win. And when you think about it, he had mastered Go as a human being with his brain and everything that he could learn, every pattern he could learn, every intuition he could get.
Right.
And he wasn't going to be getting much better than he was. He was at the peak. Other people who went and learned how to build computers and learned machine learning algorithms beat him. In other words, he had a very specialized sentience. Having a more generalized sentience, you can actually sometimes get better at other topics.
Learning how to learn is a core attribute of what makes it.
But what I would argue is, here's the question. Is an individual human being sentient in the sense that they can always get smarter? Or do you need to be around other human beings to keep getting smarter? Because the collective knowledge and learning, like language, right? I can absorb knowledge.
Yeah, no, it's the latter. It's the latter. Insights happen through discussion. It might start individually as well, but interaction of people with different domains, you put different domains together in a room, interdisciplinary work, like what you were doing with the hardware side and the software side, then that can lead to a breakthrough. It's obviously not an either or.
So I would argue that just like multicellular life was required to get intelligence of any sort, you need a civilization to have sentience. No individual is sentient.
Oh, that's fascinating. You need a civilization to have
a constant improvement. There's no other way that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Hey, look, that's a defense of civilization. I think most of us are on the same side of that bet. But that's a good way to measure. Do you have a good civilization? Can the civilization learn and refactor itself and continue to grow? I like that definition of sentience, and it goes beyond intelligence, which is more about, can you pursue an objective? Right. Can you navigate around hurdles to get towards some kind of objective? Super interesting. Let's shift gears to winners. We could talk forever on philosophy. I think it's incredibly fascinating. I do think that there's merit in people thinking through what is a test for subjective experience, but we haven't figured it out for humans. So I don't know what we're going
to do. I add one more thing. Atomic experience that you can't go deeper than. We have reflective capabilities because they're valuable. Imagine if you didn't have access to the backspace on your keyboard and you just had to type out stream of consciousness, the quality of what you produced would be worse. Reflection is helpful. Sure. Qualia seems to be those things that are below your reflective capability. You just don't have access to that part of your brain. That's qualia.
Right.
So that's
it's a BIOS.
Yeah, it's the lowest level sampling. You just can't inspect it further. There's nothing magic about it.
Exactly. And just to define that for folks, like the experience of perceiving red is an example of qualia. It cannot be reduced to anything more primary. And someone might say we can define it as an electromagnetic wave, and you can, but that's not subjective experience. That's a measurement of a scientific instrument. Our experience of qualia lives within our own subjective experience. And we presume that Jonathan and I have the same perception of red, but we can't validate that. We really don't know. So Let's go into winners and losers. You touched on this a bit earlier around NVIDIA and the CUDA ecosystem and the kernels and how people are helping NVIDIA advance its competitive advantage through this network of the open source. So I think that's, if I were to state the NVIDIA advantage, it's definitely one competitive advantage. They're also just ahead on the hardware side. They're about, it seems to be 2 years ahead of AMD and the MI300s. I'm relying on Dylan's Substack, by the way, for all of this. And that's one of the sources I use in Fabricated Knowledge, another Substack that I like to read. But is that a fair summary of NVIDIA? Can these competitors show up and take market share one day? I know they've got to stay on the beat. They got to run faster than the bear of competition chasing them and the other guy in the room. But how do you see NVIDIA's advantage?
It's purely software. I've actually had VPs at NVIDIA brag to me that their GPUs are actually physically slower than AMD's. And the reason that they win is because the software allows them to extract the performance. And that's from like people at NVIDIA, right? AMD's GPUs are fundamentally faster. You just can't unlock that because the software isn't there, right? The demo I just showed you of our chip is a 14 nanometer chip. We're competing against 4 nanometer chips. That's how many generations? Right. It's crazy. Right. And we're faster because of the software, right? That's the right advantage. Now, here's the proof that it's not a hardware issue. Yeah. What are NVIDIA's margins?
80%.
Do you think AMD would be willing to sell their GPUs for half as much as NVIDIA?
Their margins are about half as much.
But
as
just, NVIDIA. I'm saying like, I'm just trying to get you somewhere.
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. They would price it at the
market. No, of course. If they could get the deals, of course they would, right? They're trying to break into the market.
I would say if they can capture a share, yeah. Sure. I get,
and so,
why don't you go ahead?
And so are they more than half, are they less than half as good as NVIDIA's GPUs? Definitely not. It's basically all HBM bandwidth that determines the performance of a GPU. The internals almost don't matter, right? NVIDIA is the world's most successful HBM reseller, right? When you think of it that way, it's nonsense that it's a hardware differentiator. That's just silly because you can always reduce your price. The problem is the software. Getting the software takes forever.
Right.
It's slow. There's some networking isn't as good or whatever, but that's generally true of everything else. The largest system we're seeing in production right now with NVIDIA GPUs is 24 GPUs versus like the what, 8 from AMD or what? Like it's not a huge difference. We're at 640 now. So
AMD, not naive question for you here, but AMD and Intel can't throw an army of people to throw at this problem and say, look, let's build the application layer so we get more speed by identifying, you know, the top 25, 30, 40 use cases and, you know, improve competition. Why is that
the problem? So let's say you do that. Great. Now it's Saturday. So by Monday, how many new improvements are there going to be to LLMs?
Got it. So there's not a finite set of these use cases. So
you have,
it's constantly
you have to keep improving the software. You have to keep improving the implementations. Since we first got LLMs running on our chips, the number of improvements have been insane. The only reason that we can keep up is because we don't have to write the kernels. It would just be impossible otherwise. So that treadmill, because here's the way that I was. So I was talking to someone with a lot of knowledge about Google's internal like compute deployment and all that. Yeah. And they said that they had seen very clear estimates that say for Bard to be at the level of quality that they wanted, they were going to need to get about 100,000 times as much compute per Bard answer versus a search answer. So here's the question that I have for you. Do you think that Google is going to deploy 100,000 times as much compute?
No, they'll find a more efficient.
They're going to iterate. And they're going to iterate on the algorithms.
That's what led to the TPU.
But they're going to iterate on the algorithms. And what's going to matter more than the particular transistors is how quickly they can get those transistors to do the new algorithm.
I see. That makes sense. Is there an upper bound, though, to the discovery of the algorithms where at some point around the corner, and then the laggards start to catch
up? It'll probably be around the time that it's good enough. There's a saying that I love.
Yeah.
Getting a 10% improvement is hard. If someone comes to me and they say, I want to put the work in, I want to get a 10% improvement, I'm like, no.
But if you come to me and you say you want to do a 10x, I'm like, go for it. 10x's are easier than 10% because no one is trying to do a 10x. There's low-hanging fruit 10x all over the place. 10% are fully picked because everyone's trying.
So NVIDIA's edge would start to diminish when AI is good enough, and AI is a long way from being good enough. This is leaving aside valuation and market expectations and all the rest, but just in terms of the business. How about Google? Google has more compute now than all of its competitors combined due to their investment in TPU. That's what, you know, semi-analysis is saying. You're shaking your head there. So is that a maybe or not so much?
So semi-analysis is really good at getting information, but there's usually another layer of analysis you should do on top. I would not say that they have the most compute at the moment.
Okay. Look, is that part of the Grok angle, or is that just in general looking across the sector and seeing who's investing?
That's just looking across the sector. Now they're trying to become the largest, but still everyone else.
That's their ambition.
And so they're all jockeying for position.
Amazon pulled back on CapEx spending. Meta's pulled back on CapEx. So Microsoft's a player. They're Microsoft's partner with Oracle, because Oracle's got the GPUs because they don't compete with NVIDIA. It just seems like Google, because they control the supply chain, they can advantage their access to compute.
I do think that there are advantages. I don't know. Here's the funny thing. From the outside, it's always funny to see the reasoning that people ascribe to the decision-making inside of these companies. The decision-making at Google for whether or not to do something is rarely because, oh my gosh, I need this thing. The TPU was a very rare exception to that. Entire projects have been done just to get pricing competitive, right? Literally, there have been generations of system built at hyperscalers just because they wanted to put competitive pressure on the pricing. And that's the kind of thing you do when you're at scale.
Right.
But it's funny, the decision-making internally is always subtle, nuanced, and complex. And everyone outside is, oh my God, this thing's stupid, whatever. And
it's No, the management is skillful, they're capable, they're deliberate, they're thoughtful. They're looking at a lot of considerations here.
They're competing with other people who are also very skillful, deliberate, and have a lot of information.
Absolutely. It's an incredible chess game, I agree. It's one of the most fascinating games since we saw Steve Jobs and Bill Gates competing. But here you have many more players and 3D chess. You have software, you have hardware, you have business model. Do you want to make money on ads? Do you want to make money on selling subscriptions like Microsoft is doing with reinventing the SaaS? And what customer targets to focus on? So the vector space where they travel is far broader. And it takes deep deliberation to make these decisions, which you don't get the result of for many years. So no, I agree. I think the public perception of what's happening here is probably off, especially I think for Google. I'm excited about what Google's going to do with Google Gemini. Obviously, I tracked the reporting of Lambda. This is like a year and a half ago, and I thought it was incredibly impressive. It clearly blew past the Turing test, and they haven't released their best capability in the market. They're testing it internally now with their employees, and what I'm hearing back channel is that the employees love it, and that this, therefore, would have a real shot at displacing the other leaders in the market.
Let's talk about the chess game that Microsoft is clearly playing, which is when you are far behind, the smartest possible thing you can do is to raise the computational requirements of what everyone else has to do who has a large market share.
That's a good way
because
to look at it.
For a lot less compute, Microsoft make all of their users much happier.
Microsoft is forcing Google then to invest more to close a gap.
It's Star Wars. Basically, except it's a little bit inverse. It's Microsoft was behind, so their spend doesn't have to be nearly as high, but Google has to fight for every single one of those customers. By the way, that analysis right there, that's still very surface level compared to the stuff that's actually going on.
Oh, I'm sure. You made the point of Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative. Yeah. The U.S. ramps up investing here, so the USSR has to keep up or fold their cards, and they couldn't afford to keep up.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a lot.
The U.S. figured out that dropping bombs from airplanes was a really stupid and ineffective thing to do, but they kept building the program because they ran the numbers and they realized the Soviet Union was spending so much to counter the U.S. bomber program that they were spending more than we were spending for the bomber.
Right.
It helped to bankrupt them.
So like
provoking a competitive response. Google's got tons of free cash flow. They can invest in the CapEx. It's obviously impacted them, their stock price. I mean, its PE ratio is 20 now, trailing, et cetera. But how do you view the prospect and opportunity for Google Gemini?
So Google has the people to do amazing things. Remember, AlphaGo is there. AlphaGo is basically an early prototype to large language models. It's exactly the same thing, but except for spaces on a board, it's which token do I play, right? Or which token do I speak? I think with Larry and Sergey rolling up their sleeves and getting involved,
founder engagement, it's a big deal. I agree.
But I actually, before they got involved, I actually told an analyst one-on-one, I'm like, whether or not they win or lose, I think is going to depend on whether or not those founders get back in. Because Sergey's really into the machine learning. He's super deep into it. He's not going to be letting people push back and say nonsense. He understands this stuff.
Yeah, the three CEO caliber, founder caliber people at the helm, that's rare to find.
But on the other hand, they have a big business to protect. And that's always a thing to navigate. And are they going to do what they need to do to be successful, I think is the question. I think the good news is that they have the founders there at home and willing to say, you know what, I don't care about tradition. We're going to do this and we're going to win. I don't think you can predict the winner. It's
too early. I agree it's too early. Sure.
But it's in play. It's in play. That's interesting.
It's in play. Look, on the model, it's too early to say what the right model is. It's subscription. I'd be willing to pay $20 a month through Gmail to have my AI assistant and integrate it with Chrome and my web experience and my phone. I'd probably switch to the Android at that point. So I think they have shots on goal. Just in terms of technically, though, and you pointed out that the DeepMind team is there, they still have the talent. Google has been the recruiting ground from all sorts of these startups, right? OpenAI's leadership team, they coached incredible talent from Google. Ilya's ex-Google, or your ex-Google.
So, right? I think 2016, I was at Google X, and I remember Sergey put together a dinner of all of the top AI talent at Google X, not all, at Google, but at Google X. And I got invited and I said to him, I'm like, Ilya just left for OpenAI. I'm freaked out.
What year was it?
2016. It was somewhere around that.
2016.
Maybe it was like, okay. I think it was 2016. It was like around then. Yeah. And I was like, I'm worried that all of our talent is getting poached. And he like, his eyes lit up and they started doing stuff. I'm seeing all sorts of people move everywhere right now. It's like a game of musical chairs. You just don't know where anyone's going to be. I was talking to someone at one of these large AI companies last night. And I'm like, and when working on the TPU, I was talking to this guy in like this thing. And they're like, oh yeah, that guy now works here. And I'm like, wait, what? They're just,
what? Are they jumping for equity, cash comp? What's the
I don't know. I think some of it is you're at a place long enough and you just feel like moving. There's an element of that.
Well, secondaries are going to happen. This OpenAI $86 billion valuation, I assume that'll continue to close. I got a note this morning that SPV, these funding rounds are still getting done. So maybe they get cash on the table and they reset, get early at another startup and ride that.
I mean, when you're paying top price for talent, you're renting that talent because someone else is going to come in and pay top price. You have to get people who believe in the mission and who see the longer vision. Otherwise, it's just, any startup that always offers top price, you're going to see huge churn. And because there's always, would someone not offer twice what a lot of the people are making at OpenAI?
For that IP in their brain, yes. If you don't have to tune a model because they've got the parameters in their head, for sure, that's worth a lot of money. It's you need a leadership, a messiah-like leadership to retain talent, pay them below market comp, like Sam at OpenAI. He pulled that off. There's some edge there, but I do think that competition is coming. To your point, so early. We've got Google, based on what you're sharing here, still has deep benches of talent. I wasn't sure about that going into this, and you reassured me of that, unless you see it differently, but looks like they still got a reservoir of talent.
Actually, here's the funny thing. The talent in the TPU team has turned over so many times that I was at a party last week. And I bumped into someone who had recently left Google and very smart. Like I was talking to this person. I'm like, wow, they got some good talent on that team. The person had left since. And I realized he worked on a generation after another person. Like he's three generations in on that. There's still, don't forget, it's not only that yeah, they're losing great talent. They're discovering and bringing great talent in as well. I wouldn't be overly concerned about that. And there's also something to be said about bringing in hypos or high potential, because they don't know what can't be done. And they often will do things that are unexpected and very useful. Whereas the people who have been there for a long time are like, no, this is the way it's done.
It's a different way of thinking. Fascinating. Let's shift gears and respect to winners and losers. I'm going to share my screen here. I'd love to get your perspective on names that you think people are not talking about. And maybe it's through your experience having to work with them, different providers in the semiconductor supply chain. So I've got here's a list of different firms that are out there. We talked about GFS, we talked about NVIDIA, we talked about AMD. Are there names that pop from a winners and losers perspective for you that people, or names that people are not talking about, but have unique monopoly positions that you think might merit further analysis? I don't know if you can see that on your screen.
So instead of talking about specific companies, the macro always ends up being the best thing to bet on anyway, in my opinion.
Sure. You have more trend is up. Make sure you're on the trend.
You have more control over the macro in a company. Like, you can have a self-inflicted wound or something. I think packaging is becoming more important than the actual chip making itself. So the packaging of the chips, people are starting to understand the importance of systems over the individual chips. We win in our performance, not just because we built a better chip. We built a chip that works really well in the system that works really well. If you look at systems companies, they are highly undervalued. Now, I don't know that the systems companies are going to do anything about this. They all seem pretty happy the way they're doing things, but that would be something that could totally pop. Especially with these very large AI systems. I don't know how to do anything around the software because it's all given away for free, which probably tells you that the spend is going to flip instead of it being 1/3 to the hardware and 2/3 to the software. It's probably going to go the other way with 2/3 of the spend going to the hardware. In fact, whenever I talk to these big AI companies, the way that they're goosing us up and being like, you should work with us, is that we raised all this money to spend it on compute. And we're like, yes, we did. So you can never tell who's going to win. So let me give a sense of the level of shift that we're talking about. I don't think we are talking about another iteration of the information age. I think we're in a new age. And what I mean by that is, over the last almost 1,000 years, we've trended to being more and more information age, to the point at which that was the vast majority of the economy. And with the information age, you had the ability to transmit information perfectly. So the originator of an idea was, whoever originated it created the value, and therefore the system was designed to reward that. So we came up with IP laws, right? Patents like you brought up earlier and other things like that, so that people were incented to invent. If you invented a new drug and that new drug someone could just copy, then you would never spend all the money to develop that drug. Sure. Generative AI is different. Generative AI does the creativity, does the origination itself. And what I expect to happen over the next decade is we're going to start to realize, oh my gosh, origination is no longer scarce. It no longer needs to be protected. Instead, before the information age, what was it? It was the person who knew how to treat your snake bite. That was valuable because they had the information in the moment it was needed. Right. And so I think you're going to see a little more, oh, I can develop a custom drug specifically for you with no side effects because I've analyzed your DNA. So it's the process itself and the apparatus.
Totally see your point there, right? In the information age, patents matter to deliver return to people that take risk and to invest capital. So you have a tragedy of the commons without patents. People will not take the investments that they should for public good unless they're protected from competition so they can recover that. So you're saying that's not necessary because idea generation is cheap. That's going to go to zero. So why protect it? Don't encourage it. It's the delivery and access and the tailoring of that, call it the last mile to the end user, that's going to capture that. I agree with that. It really is about the user experience. It's not just the intelligence, we are moving from the age of information, of which we have way too much, to the age of insight and perspective and context. And cracking that usability layer is the hard part. Like, what is the new UX form factor? There's a rumor that Sam is working with John Ivey from Apple. Pretty sure the phone will still be involved in some way, probably AirPods 2, AI, some loose things out there, but Apple's got the iVision Pro that they're working on. Meta's got these Ray-Ban glasses.
That's the problem. You don't know who generative AI is so new. It is so alien to us that you've not developed the intuition to be able to rank them appropriately. And the search space is too huge. There's too much noise. Focus on the picks and shovels. Here's the thing. We moved from the energy to the information age. Now we're in the compute age and all that. Thing is, we still need energy. All this stuff burns power, right? We're going to need power no matter what.
You're singing music to my ears. Now, that's our whole thesis is betting on the silicon layer. And we've been offered opportunities to invest in various application layer companies. And I'm sure they're going to be world transformation changing. But it's hard to pick the winner. And we're betting silicon layer, public markets. And to your point on the picks and shovels, that's a reference to Levi Jeans and the gold rush. You didn't try to bet on the miner. You bet on Levi's. Levi's is still around today. And the valuations are compelling as compared to Mag 7 big tech stocks and as compared to an $86 billion valuation. OpenAI spends $1 billion on CoreWeave.
Yeah.
And it generates about $1 billion of revenue. And I think CoreWeave's going to go public next year. By the way, I'm long CoreWeave.
And then where does CoreWeave spend their money?
Exactly. Trace the supply chain. And NVIDIA GPUs NVIDIA's getting
huge margins on that, right?
So that's right. 80%. And NVIDIA, of course, did that round trip trade back into, they invested into CoreWeave. They also use Cloudflare, which is insanely valued right now. I think it's a fantastic business, but a great business doesn't mean a great investment. It's just too rich and expensive. But I agree. I think that's where we're focusing our time and energy is going through the supply chain and trying to find those non-consensus. That's interesting this week. And NVIDIA was down for the week. And semiconductors are one of the three prongs of our market compass to assess the direction of these things. But other semis are starting to outperform from a relative strength basis. There's more work to be done.
And the question is, how do you make it a macro bet? Because look, I remember very early on, first fundraising round of Grok, we pitched a VC. The VC said at the end of the pitch, I'm going to short NVIDIA. Big mistake, right? The thing is, I guarantee you, no matter how successful we are, anyone else is, NVIDIA over the long term is going to become more valuable because there's more for them to do than they'll ever be able to satisfy. That's probably true of a bunch of other companies in this space. And if you invest in one of them, they go down a little bit. You're like, oh no, the macro trend here is the world needs more compute. And,
yes,
and the way I to agree. Think about this, for the last, are you familiar with Jevons paradox?
Okay. No, tell me. I love
paradox. 1850s, 1860s, Jevons, if I'm pronouncing his name, or this English economist, was studying coal, which was the thing that you did because at the time coal was fundamental to success for England. And what he noticed was every time steam engines got more efficient, the amount of coal purchased increased. Hence the paradox. But what happens is when the efficiency of the steam engine improves, the economics improve, more things become economically viable, people buy more. Right. And so the total usage of coal doesn't converge, right?
The end market expands.
So for the last 60 years, every decade, almost like clockwork, compute has gotten 1,000 times cheaper per operation. And this is really another way to look at Moore's law, right? The actual economics is about 1,000 times cheaper per op performed. The spend has gone up 100,000 times. So the total, the usage has gone up 100,000. So the spend has gone up 100x every decade. Is that going to stop?
Right.
Only if compute stops getting more efficient. And it's not. It keeps getting more and more efficient. So the total spend is going to grow.
Yeah, no, I agree. I totally agree. I think taking a macro sector approach rather than trying to bet on one horse, and there are a lot of dynamics here, and the future is uncertain. Get the headline thesis right. look for good businesses, good management with good valuations and good growth and a competitive advantage, and you'll do fine. Well, this is terrific, Jonathan. Any concluding remarks or questions, or if you want to make a call to the world, if you want to reach out to your customers, take advantage of it now. Really thoroughly enjoyed this.
So visit our website, grockwithaq.com. You'll share the link. And then the other thing that I want to put a bug in everyone's ear, open source is actually the most important thing for AI safety. Thinking that AI is going to take over on its own is a bit like the sort of fears we had in the 1950s that mutant monsters would get irradiated and then they would turn into Godzilla. And the question you have to ask then is, where did Godzilla get all the fish to get that big? It just couldn't happen, right? AI runs on scarce resources. Those scarce resources are the tokens, which require compute, which require energy, which require all these other things. The real issue is how people use this. And the best way to make sure that people understand, can defend, and do the right things is to make sure that everyone has access to AI. And open source models, those that are available, are one of the best possible ways to accomplish that. It's just like security with Linux. Used to be the zero-day exploits, the things that hackers would pay for, they would pay more for iOS exploits because they were rarer than Android. It's flipped. Open source always wins in the end for safety.
I love it. And thank you for addressing that from an alignment perspective. Thank you so much. Until next time, Jonathan, thank you for the perspective and insight. Take care now.
Thank you. Be well.